It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we hear about an effort to save a local landmark from demolition in Eau Claire. That's in today's installment of Curious Wisconsin.
First, sorority and fraternity recruiting drives are under scrutiny at UW-Madison as officials are considering pushing back their traditional pledge recruiting start time to later in the fall or even eliminating it.
The announcement ignited strong opposition from members of the Greek system, saying a delay would be disruptive at best. An all-out ban would maybe kill the university, fraternity, and sorority system itself. For an overview of what's at stake, we have with us Eric Knievy. He's Assistant Dean and Director of the Center for Leadership and Involvement at UW-Madison. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So first, how does it work right now? What is the schedule and why might it be disruptive?
Well, right now the schedule is that students come onto campus and move-in days into the residence halls happen late August, and during that time, recruitment for our fraternities and sororities starts. And the reason that we decided to look at this was last year we had a conflict with a religious holiday. We were able to work around that, but through those conversations decided it might be time to look at it further just to explore the options because we know other campuses have looked at delayed, which is later in the semester, and deferred. I want to be clear that in no situation are we looking to eliminate recruitment. Mm-hmm. Recruitment will happen. It's just a matter of when it will happen and what's in the best interest for students and for our organizations.
We've opened up this conversation now. What are the concerns that are on the table about this early recruitment, getting students basically as they start their classes, maybe even before? What are the downsides there? What might be the advantages of a delay?
I think one of the things that we were looking at is as students first get to campus, are they ready to make the decision to join an organization for life and to make that lifelong commitment to a Greek life organization, which is about joining an organization for the ideals and values that they espouse? And I kind of liken it to Maslow's hierarchy. As students first get to campus, those immediate needs that they need to take care of, their housing needs, their where are they eating, what, how are they getting food, how are they getting to class, all those kind of things are top on their mind. And it's hard as students make those choices. Now, students make those choices all the time, and we were just wanting to consider, might it be helpful if they could wait and be able to make a more informed decision about joining an organization?
Well, there's an ongoing conversation on this campus, around the state, actually, about underage drinking on college campuses. Fraternities and sororities are fairly or unfairly billed as places with high rates of alcohol consumption. Is that part of the discussion here with new students maybe being exposed to a high alcohol environment right off the bat?
Well, recruitment on our campus is a dry process, and so when fraternities and sororities are going through the recruitment process, all of their events are not allowed to have alcohol at them or a part of them. If they are found to do that, then we would hold them accountable. So I would say that while alcohol is a concern, that's not the primary driver for this review.
What's been the response so far from members of the fraternity and sorority community on your campus?
I would say, understandably, there's been some concern and wanting to know what this will mean for them. Admittedly, I think there's been pieces of information that get out and maybe not completely correct. For instance, today in the news, it was, you know, the headline was that, you know, we were looking to eliminate recruitment, mm-hmm. and nothing could be further from the truth. And so I think little things like that where we are looking at when is the best time to do recruitment. And so I think what was intended to be said was that we are looking at possibly not doing recruitment in the fall. And so those kind of misperceptions, I think sometimes the fears that people have, they jump on those and kind of can get rolling pretty quickly.
Who do you want at the table? Who are you seeking input from?
Well, the Greek Recruitment Advisory Committee that was formed has sought opinions from all of our four Greek councils. We have four Greek councils on campus: our Interfraternity Council, Panhellenic Council, National Panhellenic Council, and our Multicultural Greek Council. As well, we've also reached out to the housing boards and the different alumni groups on campus and tried to get representatives of all of those groups to be a part of those discussions.
Now, people who've been on a campus and joined a fraternity or sorority know what it was like for them. Those of us who haven't, maybe look through the lens of movies from Animal House to Old School. paint us a picture of the role that the Greek system plays on a campus like UW-Madison.
Well, I think in its ideal form, the role that a Greek life organization plays is to provide a space for a student to kind of find themselves and learn about who they are. Just as most of our involvement opportunities on campus, we would hope that those opportunities are helping students to reflect on who they are, reflect on who they're becoming, and helping them to prepare themselves for life after college.
You mentioned looking at examples around the country of maybe some other schools that have dealt with these issues. How about here in the state? Does somebody in a job like yours communicate with other campuses, say in the UW system, and share ideas on how to deal with these issues?
Oh, sure. We reach out to UW system schools to talk about it. I also reach out to our Big Ten colleagues to talk about how they're dealing with issues, not just about Greek life organizations, but about a whole host of issues that we deal with in terms of leadership and involvement opportunities on campus.
So if, I don't know if there's an answer to this yet, but if this recruitment drive is moved back, like how far back would it be moved?
Well, there's three options on the table right now. One is leaving it where it is, which is entirely possible. The second is a delayed recruitment, which would mean it would move further into the fall semester, say in October sometime. And then the third option would be deferring it until the second semester, so probably sometime in late January, early February.
Now, maybe this is a fine point for listeners, but on a campus like UW, it seems like over the years, rental commitment times keep moving earlier and earlier. Housing is part of the Greek system for many. Does that create an additional problem when you're trying to figure out, am I going to be living in a fraternity or sorority house? Do I need to be, you know, getting a down payment on an apartment?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think that's the kind of information that will be included in the report when we look at all the options. Those will be some of the kind of impacts that we'll want to share with the group that will be considering this information when we present it to them. I also think that fraternities and sororities can continue to look at second, third, and fourth, and fifth year students for recruitment during that time. And so there still are a pool of people that they can look to fill their houses with.
It sounds like all in all, your goal is to not have this be a big bombshell for the Greek system on the campus.
Yeah, I would say that's correct. I think our biggest goal here is to do what we think is in the best interest of students and organizations.
All right, Eric, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us up here today.
All right, thank you.
That was Eric Knievy. He's Assistant Dean and Director of the Center for Leadership and Involvement at the UW-Madison. We turn now to a story out of Eau Claire and a local landmark that just barely escaped the bulldozers.
For decades, a huge ornamental pagoda stood atop a building near a major intersection in town. But with the building vacant for years, plans were made to demolish it and the pagoda along with it.
That didn't sit well with the community. Faced with impending demolition, a group of community members, businesses, and preservationists came together last week in an attempt to rescue the pagoda and transport it to safety.
Today in Curious Wisconsin, we look at the saga of Wu's Pagoda, and here to help us do that is Susan McLeod, director of the Chippewa Valley Museum. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, Susan, let's get some background on this. Where was this pagoda on top of the building in Eau Claire?
Well, it was sitting at the intersection of Hastings Way and Brackett Avenue. And until just a few years ago, Hastings Way was the main Highway 53 going up north from Highway from Interstate 94. And there's a bypass that's been built now, so it's no longer the main cutoff to head up north. And so that area is changing back more to a regular city street. But it is a very busy intersection, and this is a very recognizable landmark.
Well, that's the where. I'm curious about why there's a big pagoda sitting on top of this building.
Well, the restaurant was opened originally in 1950 by Jimmy Wu, who was immigrated from China to the United States in 1925 and eventually made his way to Eau Claire, where he began to work in the restaurant industry. And in 1950, he built his own restaurant. And then there are various stories about the next step in this. But we believe that very shortly after that, a person suggested to him that his business would improve if he had something more eye-catching on his building. And the suggestion was a pagoda. A pagoda structure, not an actual pagoda, obviously. And so the pagoda itself is about the same age as the restaurant building. And for many years, it was a marker on Highway 53, not just for residents, but for people heading north. Once you saw the pagoda, you knew you were in Eau Claire.
Exactly. As I heard you describe where it was, I've driven by this pagoda. But I wonder, for Pagoda 101, what is a pagoda and what did it look like?
Well, a pagoda in Asia would be a religious structure, but this was not, that was not its purpose. It was always decorative on top of the restaurant, which was a Chinese restaurant, so they were relating the image of the pagoda to the fact that it was a Chinese restaurant.
And I'm imagining, I've been to Eau Claire, I don't remember pagodas otherwise being a big part of the architecture there. This thing stood out, right?
It definitely did. It was our one and only pagoda, and still is.
And so the building that housed the pagoda is getting torn down. Why is the building getting torn down?
Well, the business was, it was in the hands of the Wu family up until 1978. It continued as a Wu's restaurant under the same name for maybe 20 more years or more. And then it was sold and it became a bar with live music for a few years. And then that business was closed. So it has been sitting there on fairly prime real estate for Eau Claire, closed for a number of years. And so in the last year, the current owner had been in negotiations with CVS, the pharmacy company, about using the site for a pharmacy. And as that was about to go forward, that's when it became known in the community that likely the building would go and the pagoda with it.
So you're the director of the Chippewa Valley Museum. This demolition is happening. I imagine the museum signal goes up in the sky. What was your reaction to that?
Well, people had been talking to us actually for several years about the pagoda long before we thought there was any threat to it. It's not a small object. It's somewhere between, it's 20-some feet tall, probably. We haven't quite taken all its exact measurements yet. So you always have to question an object like that, whether you as a museum can handle something that is that big and whether you can take care of it. And the thing about it was that people from the community, in addition to just our own internal discussions about this object, people were calling the museum, emailing the museum, talking to each other back and forth on websites. In the East End neighborhood that the pagoda was on the edge of, the softball team, for example, is called the Pagodas. So for that area of town, it was a very significant, iconic structure. For the whole town, it was a landmark, an iconic thing that, you know, sort of told you where you were in town. And for people traveling back and forth on Highway 53, it told you you were in Eau Claire. So it had a lot of significance to a lot of different people.
Were you surprised that people felt so strongly about this, that they had an attachment to it that would, you know, last enough to prevent a destruction of it?
No, I'm not surprised at that. I feel that people do often feel the loss of things that help them identify themselves with their community. There have been some losses of some significant structures, or there may be some losses of significant structures in Eau Claire in the near future. And those were things that really, maybe there wasn't a way to interact with this. Now, in no part of this was anyone really talking about trying to save the restaurant building itself. It was really the pagoda that was on top of it. And so that is a more feasible thing that you can try to do. But given the time frame, the fact that once it became known that the property was going to be sold for another purpose that would cause the site to be cleared, until the time when it would have to be cleared, there were only about maybe 2 months, 2.5 months, and then in the last 3 or 4 weeks, it became known that not only was the pagoda at risk, but that the time was very short. And so then people from the community came forward when asked if they could help figure out how to do this in this short period of time. They really came forward to help.
So, and how did they do that? How did this come together, and what did they do to save the pagoda?
Well, a number of people had shown some interest in it, and they tried to get an idea of how it was actually built so that it could be determined if it could even be done. And once that became clearer, a man named Dick Hayek, who likes to work on these kinds of operations and had worked on several others, came forward, and he said he could make contacts, and the museum has a lot of friends in the business community in Eau Claire, and eventually 5 or 6 different businesses brought the heavy equipment and carried out the move, which is, you know, not, you just can't walk over and pick up a 20-foot high pagoda. That's a big operation. And so all of these different parts of the community came forward to figure out if this was possible and then to carry it out.
Must have been kind of surreal, huh? This giant pagoda gliding through town to its next destination?
Well, of course, that would have been quite surreal. But in fact, it couldn't be carried upright.
Uh-huh.
So really one of the tricky parts of it, for two reasons. One, if it could potentially be going under wires that weren't, if you have to remove the wires, you make a much bigger operation out of it. And also, in a true pagoda fashion, it has projecting points that curve out from all the corners, kind of going up in layers. And you couldn't, and those are wood, and you couldn't lay it down and have those corners taking the weight of the whole pagoda. So it was, the top part of it was taken off. It has a steel understructure. It had kind of a loop at the top where they were connected together that they could hook onto, and they could, it was not actually sitting flat on the roof. It was, the steel legs were sitting on footings on the roof, so they could cut it free and brace it and then bring it off the roof and then tip it onto a flatbed truck. The flatbed truck had been donated. One of the big construction companies in our area sent over someone with what they call cribbing, which are basically just big lengths of about 8x8 timbers. And it was kind of like playing Lincoln Logs, placing them all along this this tapering form so that it could be solid on the flatbed, laying on its side without any of those curved projections touching.
So you've got it saved, you've got it moved. Now what? What is the ultimate destination of the pagoda, and what are people going to do with it?
Well, the museum doesn't really take things that it doesn't have an interpretive purpose for. Mm-hmm. We may not have an immediate interpretive purpose. We may not plan to exhibit it for long periods of time. We have a number of artifacts that are like that, where we can only use them occasionally, often just because of their size. And so at the moment, there was no place. The museum is sitting in Carson Park, which is a large city park in Eau Claire. There was no place on our grounds right now that we could put it, but the museum has a future plan for improving the exterior of the building, doing some site work to create a seating area. And at that time, and that plan is, it's not underway, but the design of it has been developed. And so at that time, we think we can adapt the plan so that the pagoda could sit on the museum grounds. In the meantime, it's in a temporary location. And anytime you accept a large artifact, you have to do a lot of thinking. One of our large artifacts is a 1931 fire truck. It's not easy to manage. You can't even drive it very easily. It has mechanical brakes. And another one, it used to be the centerpiece of our first regional mall, and it was a replica of Big Ben, the clock tower in London, called Little Ben, because it was London Square Mall. And that artifact also belongs to the museum. It's a little bit shorter than the pagoda, so it will have an inside location soon.
Okay, Susan, we'll watch for the pagoda on the museum grounds, hopefully in not too long. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for your interest.
And we sent out the word. We've got a lot of pictures coming into the pagoda. We'll have that up on the WPR.org site, I believe, later today. That was Susan McLeod. She's director of the Chippewa Valley Museum, talking about Wu's Pagoda.
In the wake of the shooting of a 10-year-old girl in Milwaukee last week and a spate of shootings at the end of a ceasefire week just before, the city and the state have opened up a discussion about gun violence and how to prevent it.
The conversation has engaged political leaders, police officials, and community members in Milwaukee. It even spilled over into some political back and forth in the race for governor. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett has said the city is tackling the issue on all fronts. He joins us now to give us an overview of the problem and what the city is doing to address it. Mayor Barrett, welcome to the show.
It's great to be on your show.
Well, we mentioned the very sad shooting, a 10-year-old girl, other high-profile shootings in Milwaukee over the last few weeks. Why did these particular shootings capture so much attention and start this conversation?
Well, for years, what I've been saying is that my vision for this city is I want this to be a city where, during the summer months, a grandma can sit on her front porch and watch her grandkids play safely in the front yard. And I want that for every single neighborhood in Milwaukee. And that's something I think people want to see everywhere in America. This young girl, Sarah Guyton, 10 years old, was not in her front yard, but she was about 50 yards from her front yard. And her home was literally kitty-corner from the playground she was shot on. So it was 7 o'clock in the evening. She was playing near the jungle gym, which is what we want to have every 10-year-old kid do after dinner. And you had these two young thugs that decided they were going to solve their problem and start shooting each other right in front of this playground. And she is still fighting for her life. She's in grave condition. And it's because of these two young people who decided that they wanted to solve their differences. And they didn't care at all whether someone else was going to be hurt and possibly killed in the aftermath of this. And it is so offensive, I think, to everyone who sees it or hears about it, that it puts the spotlight on all of the issues surrounding this. So, not surprisingly, one of the first cries you hear is, well, you have to hire more police officers. Well, what we find out in the aftermath and the apprehension of the shooter is that he's 18 years old and he has been arrested 15 times. Now, who has arrested him? The Milwaukee police have arrested him 15 times. So what does that say? That says the Milwaukee police are out there, they are doing their job, and they're arresting him over and over again. And so the question of whether we have enough police officers, I think, gets somewhat answered in that by the fact that he's committed these crimes previously and he's been arrested. But then you look at the FBI data that was published just last week, and they looked at a 2012 per capita comparison of the 600 largest U.S. law enforcement agencies, and Milwaukee is the eighth highest, just behind Boston, in sworn officers per 10,000 residents. So here we are with over 1,800 cops on the street. So we've got a lot of cops on the street. So that's not the issue per se.
Well, but you've got police out there able to arrest them after the fact. Is there something about having more of a police presence or maybe changing police strategy to prevent this, to have a presence that makes this hopefully not happen in the first place?
Again, we are fighting this on every front. And yes, to answer your question directly, yes, we do. We have a strong police presence working with community groups, working with block clubs. In each district, there is a monthly community meeting where interested people in the community can come in and they can work with the police officers. We use data-driven policing. In other words, if the police start seeing a pattern of behavior, what they do is they start flooding that area. So that if you know that on a certain block or a certain area you're seeing criminal activity, they just move the troops over there as you would expect them to do. So that's a way for us to cut off some of this behavior if you know that there's a particular feud going on between different factions in a neighborhood. So I just want to stress that there is a very strong police presence here.
Before so we move Sorry, before we move on from the police presence issue, the Milwaukee Police Association last week issued a press release saying you're in effect, you've got the police, but you're not keeping it full strength. You've got furloughs, and that's keeping the actual number of police on the streets down. How do you respond to that?
I respond to it that they get union dues for having members. It's a membership drive is what it is. Again, you look at the FBI data. The FBI data says that this city has the eighth highest concentration of police officers in the country. I don't think you or anybody else wants to and a lot of these cities, you look at Boston, for example, and I don't know all the other cities ahead of us, they're going to be cities that are going to be cities that have millions and millions of visitors. Because we're not one of those cities like a Boston or a Washington or New York where we have that many outsiders, we are able to put so many of these police officers in the city. But frankly, there's been a lot of disagreement between me and the head of the Milwaukee Police Association because I fought them so strong on trying to make sure that the police officers who had agreed to live in the city of Milwaukee didn't move out of the city of Milwaukee. And they were able to get the governor and the legislature to change that. So don't be fooled by that being just a law enforcement issue.
Well, the police presence is one of the fronts you're talking about in the effort to control gun violence. You also touched on another one, getting the community on board. What can community groups and everyday citizens do to try to change, I don't know, the culture that leads to this gun violence?
And I'll be very blunt here because I'm contacted whenever there is a homicide, and it's actually changed over the years. For the first few years I was mayor, I would get called whenever there's a homicide. Now, because of technology, I get an email, and I get an email not just for the homicides but for the non-fatal shootings as well. And this is something that I say in all parts of our community, particularly ones where it's most relevant. I'm sorry to say this, but when I get that message, particularly on the north side of the city of Milwaukee, the first thing that's going through my mind is this is going to be a young African-American man. And I'm sorry to say that, but that's what I'm thinking. I'm also sorry to say that I'm usually right, that the victims of homicide, the victims of shooting in this city are disproportionately young African-American men. Next comes young African-American women. Then on the south side, there's a smaller pocket of Hispanic men and Hispanic women. So there's a lot of talk about disparities in criminal justice. But by far, the largest disparity is that the victims of violent crime in this city are African-Americans. And sadly, the perpetrators are African-Americans. So you're asking me what I'm doing? Just seconds before this radio interview, I was sitting down with several African-American ministers to talk about this, that I can't expect, given the makeup of the state legislature and the governor, that they're going to come to our rescue. And even with the president, I can't pretend that they're going to be able to solve this problem. What we have to do is we do have to have a cultural change in this community that says that you just do not accept this. I need this community to be engaged and enraged at the level of violence and the number of victims who are African Americans.
So if presumably people are enraged, if there are these shootings in their neighborhoods, what can they do about it? They can't arrest the perpetrators. They're not necessarily going to put themselves
at risk.
Well,
let me tell you the story.
What difference can they make?
Let me tell you the story here. And this is, a real world story. This is last Thursday or Friday morning. I was at a neighborhood event where we were doing a new neighborhood pocket garden. And a woman came up to me, a very nice woman, and she said that her son was a felon. And she didn't like this notion that felons would have to serve a mandatory prison, which is something the chief of police here has been advocating that I support. That if you have a felon and you have a gun, that's it. It's over. We have to send the message that this is not acceptable behavior. And she does prison ministry, and she said that her son is a felon. He said, but he's got a gun. And she said he bought it privately. He bought it in West Bend. And she said, I can't believe they sold it to him. And I'm thinking, well, your son bought it. So there's two people that did something wrong there in my mind. And she said he's not a menace. And I'm thinking, you just told me your son's a felon. He can't legally own a gun, and he's got a gun. And I said to her, I look at all the data on these shootings, and they're describing your son. That's who the victims are. They're people who have criminal records, by and large. Sierra's an exception, where the perpetrators and the victims both have arrest records. They're both felons. They both are in possession of a gun. I said, I might be seeing you at a funeral, and I don't want to see that. So you're right. It has to be a cultural change, a dramatic cultural change that's going to change this.
Your police chief there has said something along the lines of the need to change the calculus for that young man who right now feels less safe without a gun. And the consequences of having that gun don't balance that out.
Right, and that's exactly what he says over and over and over again. But it goes beyond that, too. It goes beyond that because I hear this over and over again where someone says, well, I need to have a gun for self-protection. And my reaction to that is, if you're going someplace where you need to have a gun for self-protection, maybe you shouldn't be going there. Maybe that's the wrong place to be going. But it goes deeper. It goes deeper than even that. And I'll just use a real world example. Again, these are all crimes where every victim was African American on Sunday night, the day before we apprehended the shooter in the Sierra Guyton case. Three shootings, multiple victims. The first one was over a card game. The second was over groceries that were spilled on the stairs of a flat between the upstairs and downstairs. The third was a shooting over a woman. That's what I'm talking about. That's what we have to change. Groceries were spilled, an argument ensued, and multiple people were shot. A card game. Multiple people are shot.
We're talking with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett about the gun violence on Milwaukee streets and initiatives that he and others are taking to try to get it under control.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to happen to lower the amount of gun violence in Milwaukee? What do you want to hear and see from Mayor Barrett, from police, from the state, and from the people of Milwaukee? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. We're talking with Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett about Milwaukee's high rate of gun violence and what's being done to address it.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What needs to change in our policies, in our policing, in our public minds? 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. To your calls in just a minute. Mayor Barrett, first I wanted to ask you, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel decided he didn't want to wait for state or federal gun control efforts. He's promoting an idea of requiring videotaping of all gun sales in his city. What do you think of that idea or other possible municipal approaches to gun sales?
Well, several decades ago, the state legislature took away the right for local units of government in the state of Wisconsin to have laws that are different from state law. So we are barred from doing that. The issue, though, as it relates to Milwaukee, there basically are no gun stores in the city of Milwaukee. They're just outside the city limits. So passing that in the city of Milwaukee, even if we could, I think would raise, you know, some difficult issues of whether it would be effective, because West Milwaukee, West Allis, north of the city are where probably a lot of the people purchase their guns when they buy them legally. I think that the other issue, of course, is many of these sales are taking place privately, either online at gun shows or just through individual sales. And that's where I continue to maintain we have to make sure that people know that they are not selling their gun to someone who's a convicted felon or has a involuntary mental health commitment order against them or has a domestic restraining order against them. And we know that the governor and the legislature have refused to consider that legislation.
We'll go to our callers. We have full phone lines. We've got Girija in New Berlin. Girija, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I belong to an organization called International Association for Human Values. It's called IAHV. We conduct a lot of youth enrichment program in like inner city places where we teach breathing techniques and how to handle stress to the kids. So they would be able to control their emotions and they won't be shooting in the first place to start with.
Girija, thanks for calling. I want to get a response from the mayor. So youth engagement projects in this case, trying to teach almost mindfulness, anger control.
Well, I think those are obviously part of the equation here. And there are so many parts to this to this conundrum, that that's a big part of it. But there are other things, and things that we're doing here, for example, where I actively work to create summer jobs for young people, because if you don't give young people hope and opportunity in their lives, then you can't be shocked if they give up at some point. And I want to make sure that the kids aren't giving up. And I spend literally hours each week reaching out to businesses, asking them to help us create a summer jobs program so we can put young people to work.
Thanks a lot for the call, Girija. We'll go now to Nick in Madison. Nick, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my suggestion would probably be political suicide for you, but, you know, high school programs for anti-violence, summer programs, that stuff's great. What about getting at the root, which is, I'm guessing, kids that are just raised in a home with no supervision and or maybe weren't WIMAT to begin with? I mean, where would you have more success with, one or two kids or four to six kids? What about financial incentives to people for family planning options? When we look at how much money we're spending on the police, we're spending on our schools, which are failing, what about giving some money up front so that unwanted kids are not being born?
Nick, thanks for the call. He's making the case, Mayor Barrett, for family planning initiatives as part of the solution.
I don't know where he's going with that. I don't know how you're going to ever implement a program like that where you tell poor people they can't have babies but rich people can. I just don't see that happening.
All right. You can join in. A line is open up for you at 800-642-1234. Are you in a Milwaukee community affected by gun violence? What do you think needs to change? 800-642-1234. We've got Mayor Tom Barrett with us. We go now to Dan in Milwaukee. Dan, hi.
Hey, I was born and raised in Milwaukee, and the neighborhood that I lived in was an unsafe neighborhood my whole life. You were talking earlier about that young man that's a felon, and he felt the need to carry a weapon. And you said that it's better for him to not go where he feels unsafe. But 9 times out of 10, he's going home. And I think that there's a lot of faults that are causing this in Milwaukee. First of all, our school system has degraded over the last 40 years to the point where I don't know. You have to fight for a decent education and in the school system, and the fact that the rate of unemployment for minorities in especially the north side with young black males is just horrible.
Dan, thanks for bringing up a lot of points there. Mayor Barrett, let's start with the last one first.
I couldn't agree more with that. I mean, there is a crisis in the African-American community, particularly when it comes to male employment, that many of the jobs that people in the African-American community used to have, which were manual jobs or jobs working in factories or foundries or tanneries or breweries, many of those jobs have disappeared, and they haven't been replaced. And if you look at this city, if you go back to 1970, which to some may seem like a long time ago, I remember it, we had the highest per capita income rate for major cities in the country for African Americans. Now, many of those jobs have disappeared. And that is a big part of the challenge. Is what do you do? People have to have hope and opportunity in their lives. If you want them to stay engaged, you have to do it. Does that create an explanation for violence? No. Or an excuse for violence? No. I'm not going to allow that to be an excuse for violence. But I think people have to look at the big picture. And again, that's why we're working very hard. When I say we're working on all fronts, we're working to create jobs in the central city as well, because we know that that's part of this.
And the schools as part of the all fronts approach?
It's absolutely part of it. Again, when I'm on the phone and I'm calling business people, I say to them, look, we have an issue. We've got too high a dropout rate for these young kids. But if they're 14 and 15 years old and they don't see a job, how do you convince a 14 or 15-year-old to stay in school by saying you need this to get a job if they don't see the jobs? That's why I'm arguing with them or asking them. I'm never arguing with them because I've gotten a good response from a lot of the businesses I've approached on this, that if we want to break this cycle of poverty and ultimately this cycle of violence, it's going to be done through education, through jobs, and creating hope and opportunity in people's lives.
We've got Fawn on the line now in Madison. Fawn, hi.
Yeah, hi, thank you. I believe that everything that's been said so far, and especially what you've said, Mayor Barrett, has been really valuable, addressing education and peaceful conflict resolution trainings and employment and economic opportunities for the very poor and possibly hopeless and especially formerly incarcerated people. And I think that all of these things and more can be galvanized by an approach that treats gun violence as an epidemic, as a public health crisis. And if we approach it as a public health crisis rather than a political debate, which it too often is turned into, then we could get all consensus about this being an urgent issue that we need to all throw everything we've got at it. If E. coli were to have such an outbreak in the city of Milwaukee that 3 people died of it and scores more were sickened by it, everything, business would stop and we'd be, have quarantines, we'd have, trying to isolate the problem and find how to treat it and how to keep it from spreading.
Gotcha, Fawn. I think we get your point and not much time left. Mayor Barrett?
Again, when I say we're fighting this on every front, that's part of what we're doing. We have within our health department an Office of Violence Prevention because there clearly is a public health aspect to this as well.
Mayor Barrett, we've had some, as we said at the outset, sad stories in recent weeks and recent years. Do you see hope? Do you see signs of hope out there in the Milwaukee community that there may be a corner to turn out there?
Of course I do. Of course I do. I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't see signs of hope. And the fact is you have a small percentage. One of the callers said a lot of people. It's a small percentage of people who are committing these crimes. It's a very small percentage. Our job is to, as you indicated in one of your questions, is to first stop them before they commit the crime. But second is to have this community engaged at a level it's never been engaged in, and just say, we're not going to accept this anymore because it is an epidemic. It's an epidemic in the central city, some central city neighborhoods that are economically starved with no jobs, and this has become far too prevalent. And it's a small number of people. And what I've said over and over again, there's a lot of good people who live in these neighborhoods, and their lives are the ones that are most adversely affected.
There's a lot of finger-pointing on issues like this, state politics probably at the local level too. How do you get past that and get everybody taking responsibility for this?
I realize that just sticking my head into this thing means that I'm going to have a lot of Monday morning quarterbacks. But this is not a theoretical issue. This is a real-world issue that I'm dealing with.
Mayor Barrett, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you very much.
It's Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett talking about the ongoing conversation and effort to fix the gun violence problem in Milwaukee.
And you can share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.